normally this time of year, a show might do like a review, the biggest stories of the year. But thanks to your buddy, Sam Bankman-Fried, the news just keeps on rolling this week. And there's so much to talk about, including the fact that it looks like someone, gotta likely be Sam, is moving some of the contents of Alameda's wallets and then mixing them after several steps. Just coincidentally, now that Sam's home from court, he's home with his folks. He's got access to his machines with no restrictions. Just coincidentally, wallets that were theoretically impossible to get to have been accessed. Funds have been moved. Funds have been converted. And funds have been mixed.
And I just realized that the CoinDesk article that details Zach XBT's research on these wallets moving has been taken down. So wonder what's going on there.
Hmm.
I think that this is a we told you so moment, because when Sam was getting bail, which we also were hoodwinked because we thought he somehow had to fork up a $250 million bond or go to a bail bondsman for some fraction of that amount. Actually, because it's federal court, he was able to get away with his parents writing on a piece of paper that they promised to pay $250 million if he doesn't show up. So they got away scot-free on that bail. And when that happened, you pointed out that there is no condition that Sam not use computers. Because of how crypto token wallets and software work, that meant that the moment he got out of jail and his hands on a laptop with an internet connection, he now had access to massive amounts of stolen wealth. And someone, probably Sam, seems to be anonymizing former Alameda holdings.
Yeah.
Basically passing them through Mixer's Wasabi wallet, CoinJoin, and then finally into Bitcoin, which is, of course, the only safe and solid decentralized asset.
And it just happens to be just shortly after Sam gets out. You know, if he did this, it's so extremely brazen. You imagine him sitting in that house on a VPN doing all of this and then planning to later just say, no, it wasn't me. I don't know what happened.
I wish we could rely on the competence of our government institutions to think, well, this is probably a plan. Probably the FBI are aware of this eventuality. They bugged his LAN. They're tracking him so that they can really get the squeeze on all of these assets and collect them. But who knows if that's the case? This might have just been another huge oversight, which is kind of a theme. And you pointed out that there's sort of a reason maybe why the establishment doesn't seem to be taking Sam's crime so seriously, because SBF met with the White House just before the FTX collapse.
Yeah, and four times over 2022 alone, SBF went to the White House, and as recently as September 8th.
And he met with one of President Biden's senior advisors, not the president himself, but pretty close to the president. I mean, you don't get closer than that, really, other than shaking his hand. So that's very problematic. And I don't think that this is a U.S. partisan issue. I think Sam would be meeting with whoever was in the White House because the U.S. is a pay-to-play oligarchy. So if you make the political donations, you get to meet the politicians. That's the rules of the game. And that's the game Sam played.
Like a pro. Like somebody was probably advising him. Like somebody that has been around longer and has watched how these things work for a while. Because it doesn't seem like something that a late 20s person would be instinctively great at, or he truly is a hyper genius. I'm not sure. But as you say, Dad, you know, you pay to play, so he gets access to the White House. And to me, that leads to the idea that he was pretty close in getting a solid regulatory moat between his meetings with Gary and now his meetings at the White House, plus the money that he donated to politicians, including, by the way, politicians who oversaw financial advisory boards like Maxine Waters, got extensive amounts of money. He knew who to pay and how to play to build that regulatory moat. And I suspect he was pretty close, only to be taken out by your buddy Jerome over at the Fed and his bear market.
Jerome Powell did not get the message that late stage capitalism, late stage fiat money means that if you raise the price of money, even temporarily, you're going to create financial system insolvency. And the things that go insolvent first are the most obvious scams, like Ponzi schemes, also insolvent institutions because they need to, they have fixed expenses and they don't have cash flows. So they need to borrow to meet those expenses. That means they're always borrowing in the spot market. And as you raise that spot interest rate, by the way, I'm not saying that Jerome is actually raising the spot interest rate. I'm saying that that's the perception that the Fed is raising interest rates. And it seems like financial markets respond to the perception of the Fed raising interest rates by being a little bit more choosy about lending. And this sort of conspires to create the liquidity crunch that tends to blow up things like Alameda, things like FTX, things like
Celsius.
And gosh, what was our favorite Ponzi scheme before FTX?
Luna and Terra.
No, I meant a traditional one. There was the name of that guy, Madoff. Madoff.
Oh, sure. Well, Madoff was the last bubble. He was the 2008 collapse.
Exactly, because 2008 led to tighter credit conditions, and Madoff was less able to raise money to keep his Ponzi scheme going.
Yeah, now we just have a bunch of mini Madoffs. SBF's just one of them.
The rest are not in jail. Mashinsky of Celsius, he's still walking around.
It raises the question then, is Jerome Powell the MVP of Bitcoin for 2022?
Mm-hmm. Remember when some Bitcoiners were calling Cynthia Lummis our queen? Well, Jerome's our king.
I mean, if cracking a few of these scams is what it takes long-term to make Bitcoin a healthier ecosystem, I'm here for it. I'll stack the cheap sats. Thanks, Jerome.
This is the Bitcoin Dad Pod, last episode of 2022, recorded on Friday, December 30th. I'm your Bitcoin Dad, and I'm here, as always, with...
Oh, it's me. Hey, it's Chris. Welcome back, everybody.
Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Now, as you pointed out, there's this trope of the year in review. And actually, the reason that podcasts and radio shows and whoever does that is because there's no news near the end of the year because of the Christmas and New Year's holidays. But there's actually tons of news and tons to talk about. So today, we're going to do a lot of speculation. And we're going to speculate on an article about a potential European Union ban on Bitcoin. We're going to rant about Neil Stephenson's new L1 blockchain company called Lamia, which is just such a disappointment. Could you disappoint us more, Stephen, is the question I'm going to be asking. We read a paper about how 70% of crypto exchange volume is wash trading. Wash trading is when one entity simply moves funds back and forth to give the perception of a deep and liquid and vibrant market, but actually it's an illusion. There's really just one player and they're tempting you to come and trade by producing a lot of fake activity. It was kind of obvious that was the case, but it's interesting that other people are catching on. The European Central Bank's balance sheet is declining rapidly. It's still huge, but it's declining rapidly. And that's sort of interesting from a monetary policy, financial market, liquidity, deflation, etc. perspective. We'll talk about that. We also have a really bonkers article from Zoltan Poznar of Credit Suisse. You might recall he was a analyst who predicted a return to gold, a failure of the dollar system, and the dollar as a reserve asset after the U.S. confiscated the Central Bank of Russia's foreign reserves in collusion with the Japanese Central Bank and the European Central Bank. So this is another interesting piece we'll get into. And then we saw a really neat little privacy tool that we'll talk about. And in Bitcoin education, we are going to read something lovely from BitMEX Research about Craig Wright's Bitcoin altcoin. What's the right term there? Craig Wright's
ego coin?
The BSV ego coin of noted Satoshi Nakamoto impersonator Craig Stephen Wright. It's a nice piece about fork safety. And then we have some feedback and boosts, including a mega boost and a amusing narrative boost that we will read using the accent of Yoda from Star Wars. I hope Disney doesn't sue us over that one.
I don't think it'll be nearly good enough for them to be concerned.
Concerned? You should be.
Oh, maybe it will be.
This article showed up in Bitcoin Magazine, and it's written by this fellow. I'm not even going to try to pronounce his first name, but his last name is Cicero, I think. He's a manager of a European Bitcoin company called Relay, one of these fintechs with an unpronounceable name. And it's basically some sort of you buy Bitcoin app. And I think there's also some, it's kind of like Robinhood. I don't know if you can withdraw Bitcoin from their app, but they're a company that would potentially get regulated out of existence by European bans on Bitcoin. So they're very sensitive to the political climate in Europe. And Cicero has written this article, which is some history of the recent legislation in Europe that potentially could have banned or impeded Bitcoin, usually around attacks on proof of work and mining. And then he sort of goes a bit further and speculates that a ban is pretty likely, because it seems that at least half of the EU Parliament really doesn't like Bitcoin. But they justify it by saying it's because of the energy usage of Bitcoin. And they use some pretty ridiculous figures saying that Bitcoin undoes all of the greening that Europe has achieved. And this, of course, is preposterous, because Europe has not greened at all. What they've done is they've shifted dirty industry to China and India and then said that they've reduced their emissions. Yeah, well, technically, you've reduced emissions by shifting dirty industry to China, but you still bought the products from China. So your net emissions are actually higher than previously. You've just shifted them to China. Okay, energy complaint over. He also points out that the European Central Bank really doesn't like Bitcoin. And again, the ECB has published several articles, I think at least two this year, about how Bitcoin is totally dead and, you know, it's Bitcoin's last stand. And these ECB articles, they really trifle with your intelligence, because they are incredibly subjective. You know, they say that Bitcoin doesn't work as a payments method. Totally not true. I've used it as a payments method. Seems to work pretty fine. It really depends on your biases going into how you draw conclusions around that. And they also kind of make judgments about, well, it's clearly not money. Well, I mean, what is money? I'd love to see the conclusive definition, because it doesn't exist. It's completely subjective.
They also position proof of work as older technology and proof of stake as a newer iteration of the technology that's more environmentally friendly.
Right, which is preposterous, because proof of stake is the oldest technology out there. Proof of stake is a rebranding of proof of violence or proof of authority. You know, proof of stake is just a little bit of obfuscation in front of the people with the most money will determine the rules for everybody else. And it's been no surprise that the European Central Bank and institutional interests, be they financial institutions, banks, or regulators, they like this proof of stake model, because their power and authority in society is derived from being the people with the most money, or the ability to regulate people with money, and therefore it's a very familiar model to them.
Well, and it snaps into the existing model. They can influence that model because those models all stack.
It integrates nicely and it solves nothing, because if you merely integrate and create another layer on top of the house of cards of traditional finance and the post-Bretton Woods fiat dollar system, what have you really done? The answer is nothing. You've created another financial speculative asset, but it's going to be just as fragile as this system that is breaking all around us and related to much of the political, economic, and social upheaval we are living through right now.
And this is why the ECB continues to go after proof of work and thus Bitcoin. And what this piece speculates is that in 2025, we'll see a rating system rolled out for cryptocurrency systems according to their environmental impact within the European Union. So he says, think of energy labels akin to what you see on a fridge or a television. And of course, Bitcoin will get the worst classification. And then he shows an example of one of these that has been already mocked up. And, you know, you get a range of great to really, really bad. And of course, Bitcoin automatically gets labeled as a really bad energy consumer. It's bad environmentally. And so you look at something like Ethereum, it gets rated as grade A, triple plus. And Bitcoin gets rated as a D. And Ethereum, of course, like you said, is subject to all of those vulnerabilities and issues. And it's the exact opposite. It's like the opposite of what is actual reality, but it's the one that perpetuates their continued system. And I think this idea of labeling things based on their environmental impact could take off across the West. Western nations love regulating these label systems like this, even if they're not accurate, even if they don't truly reflect the, you know, actual nutritional impact of something that's on food or what's actually in the ingredients, even if the labels don't properly represent the violence or what the commentary is in the video or the movie that's on the children's video, they still have a label on it, right? Like, these label systems have been around forever. They're in professional industries, they're in consumer industries. They love this stuff. I could see this taking off like a meme. And I think it'd be very bad for Bitcoin, especially when you consider proof of work's capability in off-gas methane capture or incentivizing renewable solar systems or in being a reliable demand for grids like Texas to help stabilize stabilize the grid so that way in the winter, in the summer, they can keep lights on. Like, Bitcoin has a ginormous potential right there to help us incentivize a transition to a truly renewable power grid. And so it's so ironic that in order to maintain their financial systems and structures and just maintain this system that clearly is very fragile, they're willing to actually sabotage the long-term environmental potential in the name of protecting the environment.
This is obviously speculative. This labeling system hasn't come out. It's still being debated. At the same time, why would we be surprised? Because the ECB and the European Union have supported a quote-unquote green agenda that's led to an over-reliance on natural gas, which is definitely not green, a mothballing and neglect of nuclear power infrastructure, which is pretty conclusively incredibly green, and an energy crisis that has, you know, basically destroyed the economic engine of Europe, which is Germany. Germany is in contraction, and the ECB and the European Union or European Commission balance sheet is under severe pressure, because without that German export machine to create a surplus that can be redistributed around Europe to kind of keep the other less, I hate this term productive, but less productive countries subsidized and fed, the system breaks apart pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Or it might. So Europe is in a terrible position because of terrible policy. And I'm not surprised that they're ready to double down with some more bad policy.
Oh, for sure.
This is not surprising at all.
It does seem likely because that mock-up energy label that's in the article is from a commissioned work from an EU legal body that is trying to get all this together for 2025. So that mock-up is actually part of some of this work that they're considering. But I wanted to get your take on this. I agree with everything you just said, but I think what you just said has been true for the last 30 years and course hasn't changed. And so I begin to suspect that the only solution is to get ahead of it and just adopt that these are the ground rules at this point, this narrative around ESG and all of this. And Bitcoin mining, especially in the EU, has to, I think, just go super hard on green, like we see these scam chains doing, all fronting on green, all on renewables, really on incentivized renewables, methane capture, become a leader in green jobs, a leader in green investments. And they have to make a lot of noise. Like, they actually have to have like PR departments and marketing departments that actually are putting out information and social media posts and connecting with regulators, because it has to be a full-throated get-ahead response to this, including working with paying off, you know, government officials and whatnot, like all these other industries do. Because if we don't, I think we have, you know, a 20-30 year delay on mainstream adoption here. Because if you start slapping these energy labels on, you know, at first it won't really slow investors much, but over time it will start to take off. And you'll start to see the real crap cryptocurrencies, the stuff that is bad for humanity, get labeled as a safe investment and grade A. And you'll see something like Bitcoin get labeled as like the worst possible investment, and that will spread. And it's not going to ruin Bitcoin forever, but I suspect it'll probably slow things down for a bit. And I don't think there's any way to convince people that they're wrong about their environmental incentives or the policies they have in place right now. I think that momentum is just too strong for a while, and there's going to have to be more pain before that changes. So I think in the meantime, we got to play by their rule book and get ahead of it and, you know, just go all in on being the greenest of the green industry, super hard green, the biggest greenies ever. And if we don't, I imagine it's going to be a real struggle over there for a while, and it's not going to be great for the West in general.
I see your point and your concern, and I think that the source is the speed of adoption and the potential roadblocks that these arbitrary restrictions around energy that are, they're not super well thought out. They don't come out of a very holistic and intellectually curious understanding of how human civilization actually uses energy and what constitutes green.
They're making the problem worse, and they're delaying real solutions that could bring the cost of energy down for humanity at scale that would probably revolutionize civilization, right? Like, you get it, what I'm saying? Like, so not only are they delaying sound money,
these policies don't care about the cost of energy. They care about something much dumber, which is reducing energy utilization. Because there's an assumption built into this kind of restrictive green energy worldview, which is that energy consumption is bad or environmentally damaging. That actually might be true from a certain perspective. But if you think that the energy consumption that is inherent in human civilization and a consumer-based society, which is in many ways problematic, I think, then the logical conclusion to solving the world's energy and environmental crisis is to start removing humans, like, violently. Like, this is not a very good philosophy in my view, because even if you thought, like, hey, you know, the planet is literally going to die, and so we need to solve this problem aggressively, and then, you know, you go full, like... you know, final solution on somebody. This is literally the thought process that incepts extreme policies. But the thing is, there's some truth to some of this point of view. Like, having huge numbers of people buying plastic tchotchkes, wanting to eat beef all day when beef is made in industrial beef farms that, like, produce huge amounts of toxic sewage and huge amounts of carbon, that is problematic. So if that's your view of, like, what human society is, then I think that some of these conclusions around we just need to reduce energy consumption and consumption in general do make sense. And so when you say, listen, we have ways to make energy so cheap, that actually would trigger people with this kind of doom view of energy. They'd be like, oh my God, that's terrible. Stop it, Chris. You know, that's exactly what we don't want. What I'm trying to get at is that we're coming at this sense. From a super different angle.
Right.
And that's why I don't agree that going hard on look how green Bitcoin is the right way to go. Because I think that you're dealing with a worldview that is really stupid and wrong, and that reality is going to prove that worldview unsustainable through high energy prices in Europe, through the discovery that so-called renewable energy like solar and wind is not really going to work at a grid scale because of its intermittent nature, the way it turns off and off.
I know. I'm just more cynical. I think people will push it long and hard, way beyond the... I mean, they already are. But to your point, it is ludicrous because these are the same organizations and groups that are pushing electric car adoption, which is a ginormous consumer of electricity and requires a huge investment in grid availability. And they're pushing AI. And all of these proof of stake blockchains run on very powerful cloud servers in data centers that use enormous amounts of energy and require considerable cooling. They all use a ton of electricity. The electric cars, all this AI stuff that they're promoting for the future to optimize economies at the World Economic Forum, like all this stuff that they're like chattering about right now are energy consumers. Plus, they themselves, with all their fancy flights and meetings, are energy consumers. And I just don't see that ever slowing down. So you're right. Their policies don't match their actual, like, I guess, rhetoric. It seems they could go for years and years, like maybe a decade.
I think you may have killed the argument for Bitcoin to try and go full ESG, which is there's hypocrisy in this ESG narrative because the climate conference in Egypt had, you know, 200 private jets fly there. Like, they've produced more emissions for that conference than they're saving over the course of the next 5 years. So it's crazy.
And, you know, or whoever sabotaged that Nord Stream pipeline, I was reading, released 100 years worth of carbon emissions for U.S. commuters. So if U.S. commuters, the amount, number of people that are driving today drove continuously for 100 years, that's how much emissions were in just one, it was whatever nation decided to blow up that natural gas pipeline. Whatever nation did that, they committed an environmental atrocity in about 35 seconds.
And so if one military strike on a natural gas pipeline can do that, what hope do we have of reducing emissions through slow-moving policy or whatnot? It just seems quite hopeless to me. So I think that this green agenda, I mean, listen, I want to live in an environmentally healthy world. I mean, I've lived in the freaking coal fields of northern China, okay? Like, I know what the environmental apocalypse looks like. I have lived there. It is horrible. It's the worst. I mean, it just sucks. And is that the future for humanity? I don't know. It could be if things go really badly. I think what we're getting at is that the solution that the European Union and their sort of virtue signaling, hypocritical green agenda that moves dirty industry to China and then happily buys those imported goods that were made with coal, which is completely hypocritical. You've increased emissions and then patted yourself on the back. This is not going to solve humanity's energy problems and issues with pollution. What's going to solve this is a fundamental restructuring of society, potentially away from the consumer-based model and into a more sustainable, lower consumption model of human life. And we can't do that with this fiat system. you know, Bitcoin integrates into power grids and energy production in kind of an interesting way because it's a way to directly convert energy into money. That's cool. That could be useful. It also does something else because as a fixed supply currency, it doesn't require continuous expansion to function at a base layer the way that our current fiat system works. And that suggests that a Bitcoin system incentivizes saving and investment over speculation and consumption. That's obviously a very hand-wavy statement, but that seems to be a foundation for a world without the sort of wasteful consumption that seems to be depleting environmental resources. And so that's kind of my positive spin on the environmental narrative in Bitcoin.
I, as a technologist, believe that the technology gets more accessible and cheaper and becomes more available. You know, like it was 4 years ago, maybe, that I installed solar and lithium on my home. And that's been amazing for us. And just 2 years before that, it was way outside my price range, way, way. And just in a couple of years, it managed to come down into something that was viable for us. And it's pretty awesome to have that kind of individual independent power source. And I've often thought, too, it'd be pretty neat to put a few panels on the studio and just kind of supplement some of the studio's use. And as that technology gets more available and that kind of stuff gets widely adopted, I think there'll be a lot of solutions at the individual level as well. If you're right, and it seems like I do have this long-term philosophy that everything returns to the median eventually. So, and that's another way of saying everything eventually has to return to reality. So you can build these giant narrative bubbles for a while, especially when money's cheap and easy. You can really build these bubbles and finance to make it possible. I mean, we've seen how a guy like SBF can build his own narrative bubble. And if you have multiple politicians and Western governments and institutions like BlackRock that are pumping this bubble, it's going to be dominant for a while. But if you can focus on the fundamentals and you can make strategic investments that maybe seem a little like they're in the counter narrative at the time, when that bubble pops, you might be in a really great position. And I think that's where Bitcoiners will be. And in the meantime, I think we just continue to build our own local Bitcoin economy and exchange things in sats. You know, there's things like sats crap. There's, of course, things like boosts and ways to just create like the beef initiative. Like I got a whole big thing of beef now in my freezer. It's amazing. And that was through Bitcoiners and the beef initiative and kind of building out that local economy in the meantime. So that way all the plumbing is there and the software has been banged on and the front end is more user friendly. And that continues to happen. And I think that's essentially the path we're on. I just worry about this stuff slowing things down if it really takes off. But hopefully a return to fundamentals will shake everybody's, I guess, head clear, I suppose.
We're definitely not one of these Bitcoin is inevitable voices, because that's a complacent and lazy point of view, in my opinion. At the same time, Nigeria attempted to ban Bitcoin and gave up, and they're dealing with a less technologically integrated and potentially savvy population than the EU. So go ahead and ban it. See how it works out. I don't think that the EU is in a particularly strong position to impose its will on the world.
I feel like the action that we can take right now is to grow adoption, because if Bitcoin users get to a certain critical mass in the Western economies, then it's sort of inevitability. There have to be some level of capitulation by the rest of the system to integrate it, because there'll be a large enough
political force.
Yeah. You know, I've watched that happen to groups over my lifetime. It can be done, but it requires steady adoption, which is why, you know, sometimes I think people give Bitcoin a little bit of a culty label, but that's just the natural monetization process of any new asset. And then we just have to stay at it, you know, and don't listen to all the FUD. And I mean, if you can, maybe politely help people come to a new understanding about the energy situation as well.
Well, that was a satisfying rant, but I have another one for you, Chris. What do you know about Neal Stephenson?
Well, I mean, I know he's famous for being a sci-fi author. Supposedly, he's credited for being the originator of the metaverse in the early 90s.
The concept of the metaverse, right?
Right, right.
I think he called it the metaverse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he's beloved. He's a beloved figure. Neal Stephenson is a brand name at this point.
Would you be surprised if I told you that Neal Stephenson anticipated cryptocurrency in 1999?
No, I don't think I would be surprised.
He was definitely aware of the cypherpunk email list. And I think he knew about BitGold, because he wrote a novel in 1999 called Cryptonomicon, which is essentially, what if BitGold was a concept pioneered by Nick Szabo of essentially a gold repository that would then use cryptography to create a token, tokenizing gold and getting all of the ease of use of a digital asset, but backed by a real scarce asset. And in Cryptonomicon, essentially a group of mercenaries discover a cache of gold hidden by the Japanese Empire in World War II, and they plan to use that to essentially backstop a digital currency. There's also a 3D printed gun angle in here. I mean, it's really weird. It's kind of a wild story. Every nerd has heard of Neal Stephenson. The other thing about Neal Stephenson that I think, and then this is my critique, is that Neal Stephenson doesn't know how to end a novel. Every novel of his descends into a violent conclusion. It's like a bloodbath to get rid of all the characters he doesn't know what to do with. And two, Neal seems to have a desperate need to remain relevant. He wrote a book about the American Taliban that was incredibly cringe, I thought. He's also written books about the, when people were very afraid of like asteroids hitting the Earth. He's written books about that. So he's very in touch with kind of what's hot right now. He's worked on video game projects before, which generally have not gone very well. So now we come to him and the metaverse. And he, again, seems to like completely not understand what's valuable about Bitcoin and why metaverses seem like a pretty stupid idea.
And Web3 in general. So he's bringing, would you say, cachet with his name? He's bringing cachet to this idea. He's partnered up with, Vecenas?
Vecenas.
He's the co-founder of the Bitcoin Foundation. He started CoinLab in 2011. The project really positions him as a total crypto OG expert. So it's Laminia, right? L-A-M-I-N-A-1. So Lamia, something like Lamia 1, something like that. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it.
Right. We're never going to say that right.
No.
Lamina 1.
What they're planning to offer is like metaverse API in a box. Now, they don't actually design the graphical environment and the 3D part, which is inevitably going to be a tremendous amount of work, but they'll offer you all of the other bits, a layer one blockchain, some backend services, community economic systems that incentivize participation, wink, wink, wink. And of course, they're also going to be creating original content that you can feature in your metaverse world.
But they're not producing any graphics. So what does that mean?
Well, so they have an SDK. So I read the white paper this morning.
I'm sorry to put you through that.
I don't think I've ever read a worse white paper because it reads as more of a political positioning and PR positioning piece than it does a white paper. The most technical level it gets into about the blockchain is that they're using Avalanche. They don't even really get into it. And that they're going to contribute upstream to Avalanche, but they also plan to add their own proprietary crap on top of it too.
To justify raising money because it's proprietary.
Mm-hmm. They're using the Avalanche SDK. Here's in their white paper. I got a few snippets. If you want to put a link in the notes, I have like, I grabbed a few other like highlights from this worst white paper I've ever read, but here's some of like the top hits.
Oh, so did you make this paste doc? This is you? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, it's so bad, man. We should look at a couple of them. But they write, we must revisit the centralized business models of Web 2 and empower creators and consumers with greater agency, ownership, and privacy. Lame 1 delivers critical infrastructure to enable a $1 trillion economy on the open metaverse. Web 3 envisions a better world through redesigning of our lives, instituting stronger advocacy for our interests and freedom and rights. They also talk about how they have a high-speed proof-of-stake consensus algorithm.
Oh, Jesus.
Customized to support the needs of content creators. That's you and I. We're content creators. Yeah.
Okay, so let's start getting into problems. One, the co-founder, Peter Vecenas, is a joke. The Bitcoin Foundation was a joke. It was a total mess. It disgraced itself hard and fast. Mm-hmm. And then his company, CoinLab, it's five people with $1 million of funding that's been limping on since forever. Now, listen, that sounds incredibly dismissive. They might be doing something very legitimate. Except they're not. They produce nothing. So do we care that, like, has anyone here heard of Peter? No, of course not. He's a total non-entity. He adds no credibility to this project. And the moment you say high-speed proof-of-stake blockchain, that is a red flag. Because one, we all know blockchains don't scale. That's not what they do. So when you say high-speed blockchain, what you're talking about is a very centralized database server. Or, okay, you know what? We'll produce three nodes and they'll all live in AWS and maybe in the same data center so they can talk to each other at high speed.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound decentralized? No, it's just lipstick on a pig of centralization.
They also go after energy, which, you know, is my hot button. They say Lame One is a proof of stake chain. As such, it is orders of magnitude more energy efficient than previous proof of work chains. And they also say, quote, our vision of the world is not maximalist.
So this is joining the anti-Bitcoin culture war. Good job, Stephen. Yeah, it's just so Neil Stephenson. It is so close to being onto something, and then he just fudges it at the last minute. And instead of having some interesting discussion about the world is created, he kills all his characters in a shootout. I mean, it's just so typical Neil Stephenson.
To your point, so how do they do the graphics? Well, they're going to make an SDK available. And this gives you an indication of how much they care about freedom and decentralization and building the next web. They write, the vast majority of today's immersive metaverse experiences are powered by game engines that are most popular, Unity and Unreal. You know, like those are commercial engines. You got to pay high licensing fees, really restrictive. So what are they going to do about that? What are they going to do to open up the metaverse to everyone? Absolutely nothing.
Oh, nothing. Oh, you solved a big problem there. Oh, wait, no, you didn't.
They write, to make developers' lives easier, Lame One will provide a feature-rich software development kit for these engines to make it as easy as possible to get started, to be successful in integrating our blockchain into your games, immersive worlds, digital twins, simulations, and other content. Lame One will also provide the same feature set to web developers, making it straightforward for them to connect with their immersive web experiences. Oh, and you can totally join them on the centralized Discord platform to talk about their decentralized metaverse platform.
They think that there is a value proposition in the metaverse, and this is one of the examples they give.
Yeah.
A digital Gucci Dionysus bag commanded $4,115 in Roblox native cash, more than the $3,400 retail value of its physical version. This means that there's a premium on digital goods, right? Okay. One, this is one example. Anyone can create a money-losing sale as a publicity stunt. So it means nothing. When that's a trend with numbers behind it and real money behind it, okay, that I would be interested. Two, why is $4,000+ of Roblox cash equal to $3,400 of actual cash money? Because Roblox cash is less good. So more Roblox dollars are necessary to buy the same amount of real world dollars. And I know
it's called Robux.
Oh, Robux. Okay.
For the Roblox game. Oh, I know. Oh, Robux. Trust me. You don't want to know how hard I know either. It's
right,
bad.
Because your son keeps on scamming and getting scammed in Robux. Because it is it's like a kid financial speculation scam game. And the fact that this is their example of a successful metaverse when Roblox is a digital hellscape, it's perfect. You know, it really points out that they've looked at a trash trend with trash outcomes and been like, hey, we need more of that.
Well, also, it's super convenient because they even say in here, their numbers, they're looking at 2018 to 2021. They've just conveniently not looked at 2022 sales numbers. So they're looking at the whole bull run in its entirety, and they're basing these tremendous sales that are obviously indicative of how much money can be made in the metaverse. Because they also talk about how some fool spent $450,000 to buy metaverse land near Snoop Dogg's house. And they're like, look at that. Somebody was willing to spend $450,000. Yeah, it was a crazy easy money bull run. And it was everybody drunk on the fiat punch after a decade of loose money.
And that wasn't necessarily real money. They may have printed that money and given it to themselves. They may have been money laundering. Who knows? Okay.
It could have been big, massive, you know, Dogecoin games that they then flipped to Tether and then they went and bought their metaverse property.
There's no basis for the assumption that the metaverse is a thing or valuable. If what I'm saying is true, then this entire concept just completely unravels. Just to return back to Neil Stephenson's body of work, his seminal book is called Snow Crash, and I think it's worth a read. It's pretty goofy in many ways. The love interest is an underage girl on a rocket-powered skateboard. It's definitely this kind of like geek sexualization of underage girls. So that's a thing there. Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, wow, that's kind of weird. The main character is this guy named Hiro Protagonist, but he spells Hiro, H-I-R-O, like he's Japanese.
Hmm.
Okay, you're getting a sense of this, okay? The world it takes place in is the United States that's so completely fallen apart that corporations are countries and your McDonald's franchise is like nation state with rules. And the world is just endless suburban nightmare.
About 2025.
Yeah, about 2025, yeah. And so basically, he paints a physical reality that is so horrible that going into a virtual metaverse is an upgrade. So he seems to have forgotten that his sort of view of reality and why the metaverse exists is because the world is going to hell in a handbasket. I just think that that's amusing. This book, which honestly, crack a beer, eat a pizza, and page through it, is, you know, it's kind of interesting as a inspiration for the metaverse, and you might even say the open internet. There also features brain computers, samurai swords, a man with a nuclear bomb sidecar on his motorcycle and a dead man switch in his head. This sounds like your cup of tea. I would say check it out. But if this sounds like, I'm not sure I would invest in the company that this person's throwing their weight behind, you know, you might also want to consider that.
Interesting. That's a good little rundown. Thank you. I felt ashamed I hadn't read Snow Crash, but now I feel a little better.
There's also scalping. Scalping takes place in...
Oh, nice.
And a super-powered nuclear minigun.
Right.
Right.
I mean, those things sound awesome. In this world, is there crypto exchanges where 70% of the transactions are essentially washing funds? Is that a thing in the future too? Or is that just this timeline?
They never really get into the money. He doesn't do that in Cryptonomicon either, which is his, I know you're giving me a lead in, but it's just interesting that he also wrote a book about cryptocurrency and also doesn't understand cryptocurrency. So this is kind of just a this funny Neal Stephenson theme.
Hmm.
No, he does not address wash trading, funnily enough.
If this research is done, and you know how much we love this type of research, it can always be hit and miss, but this group studied 29 unregulated exchanges. I don't know why they have to throw that in there, but that's what they say, and came to the conclusion that on average, more than 70% of the volume within the platform was wash trades. Now, remind me what a wash trade is, because I'm not a day trader like you are. I kid.
Oh, gosh.
I kid.
A wash trade is essentially one entity that is trading with itself. So if you are going to log in, if you are going to create an account on an offshore exchange and become a millionaire trading crypto tokens, you aren't going to go through the effort unless you see a lot of activity on this exchange, because you have to put an effort to register and you have to send your funds to the exchange. So you expose yourself to risk because the exchange is going to hold those funds for you. But you're not going to do that unless you think, okay, there's a lot of activity there, so I have an opportunity to make some money trading with all the people who are on there. And there's a chicken and an egg problem with these exchanges, because you get people to sign up and start trading because people have signed up and start trading. So how do you bootstrap that process? The answer is, if you're legitimate, you hire a market maker, like, say, Alameda Research, and they show up on the exchange and they're like, we are ready to buy and sell at these prices. Let's go. Or you could just, you know, take 3 Bitcoin and trade it back and forth between your wallets for various prices and make it seem like, I don't know, 300 Bitcoin or something like that by just trading it back and forth a lot with yourself. And since it's on an exchange, there are no transaction fees because it's just entries in a ledger in like an Excel spreadsheet or a SQL database, which is costless. And so there's really no downside to wash trading other than if you're regulated by the SEC, they will fine you and possibly punish you in other ways. So if you're unregistered to begin with, what do you care? Go ahead and wash trade. And it's a way to essentially market your exchange and get traders on there. And of course, in the case of Alameda, that can then turn into another opportunity for profit, because you might have the ability to trade against your profit. You might have the ability to trade against your customers and make additional money once you get them on there. So wash trading is generally illegal in the regulated financial system. But if you're unregulated, why wouldn't you go for it?
And so you think this number could be legit? The 70% of their volume is this kind of activity?
I think it depends on the time frame. This is an Enver paper, so that's, you know, kind of considered pretty legitimate. And it's interesting that the two of the authors are from Tsinghua University. Tsinghua is the number one school It's an engineering school in Beijing. It's the number one school in China. You know, I think that these small exchanges, if you look at their activity in the first, say, couple months of operation, it's probably 100% or 99% wash trading. And then over time, if they take off, then the amount of wash trading necessary to sort of keep the illusion of liquidity alive will hopefully decrease. So they chose offshore exchanges that are unregulated because they're definitely wash trading. You know, that's a way to just, you know, find the thing you're looking for. But I think that the issue is the time period at which you look over it, and you can shift that time period to make that wash trading number higher or lower, I believe.
Well, now FTX is out, they got to go somewhere else, you know? They got to take that biz somewhere else, because it seems like business is down a little bit since FTX collapsed.
And why are we including this? Because this paper and the accompanying article help make the point that when Bitcoin competitors show up, Soluna, I can't even say it. What is that? I don't even know what that currency is named
Soluna.
Anymore.
Solooner. Yeah,
Solooner. XRP, they get these incredible valuations, you know, $800 billion for this token that's appeared out of nowhere. And now it's on the top 10 crypto market cap list, and people are saying, oh, it's a Bitcoin killer. Well, how do they get these valuations? The answer is things like wash trading give the appearance of a market that demands these tokens and where you can participate and, you know, sort of make some fast money. But it's an illusion because, as we said before, when you create money out of thin air, you can now spend that money to manufacture the appearance of demand for that money and cash out. And that is, in my view, clearly what is happening with 99% of these crypto altcoins.
Yeah. And then things like, you know, Soluna in particular, Matic and a few others, ADA and stuff, they're really influenced too by what investors sort of pigheadedly think will be a big platform. And I've noticed, you know, these investors that have made it really big, that especially in these last few years, they think they're brilliant because the amount of money they've made. And so that must translate to how brilliant they are. And so they will stick with these projects and continue to throw money at it because they believe they're building a platform because their ideas are so great. And clearly they're so much better than everybody else's because look at all these millions and billions they've made. And so they just keep throwing money at these projects, even though their fundamentals suck. Their adoption is way down. The biggest use cases are like things like NFT. Like Solana's actual value proposition is as a hedge against Ethereum. That's why investors bet on Solana, because they're actually betting that Ethereum is going to have some sort of issue and everyone will have to switch to an Ethereum compatible but faster chain. And that will be Soluna. And so that's why the VCs continue to put money into it. And it's the whole thing is built on a house of cards. And meanwhile, retail is the one that ends up getting dumped on. It's awful. And so you see this kind of stuff jump around. Like Solana is somewhere around $9 right now. And at the high, it was somewhere above $200 back a year ago.
I don't think there's any coming back from these sell-offs, because what we see in the history of altcoins is once you go past the number two slot, you just shoot down to number 88, you know, especially once you fall off the top 10 coins by market cap, which of course we've said is a totally manipulated, meaningless statistic. But the thing is, if you use a more sophisticated and like meaningful number, like I think Checkmatey has this thing called realized gains or something, where he looks at Bitcoin and tries to figure out the price that people actually paid for it and how much has actually gone into the ecosystem, you can suddenly see that all of the activity, all of the money is in Bitcoin, and everything else is just this tiny amount of real activity that has then been sort of magnified by wash trading and marketing to appear really tasty. And that's, of course, the incentive of altcoins.
And imagine now if we say have a risk off market for another year and a half. I think you're right. How does Soluna or Matic or any of those recover if we have a year and a half of risk off? Now, if it's 6 months, I think it's possible. I think if money gets loose again, printer go burr for some reason, rates either pause or maybe even one not even just a notch down, even just a 25 basis point notch down or something, I think you'd see people go risk on like nuts. If it's a year and a half, I think through attrition, some of the stuff will die off.
We can only hope. Speaking of things dying through attrition, the European Central Bank has seen their balance sheet plunge by nearly 500 billion euros in 1 week. Now, this is an article from one of my favorite financial market perma-bears named Wolf Richter. The European Central Bank's balance sheet is massive. At their peak, they had nearly $9 trillion of assets on their balance sheet. And what's interesting is that in the past 2 weeks, this number has stepped down. It's just sort of dropped down rapidly by 500 billion euros in 1 week. Why is this interesting? It's because they allow loans to roll off. They're not constantly sort of issuing new loans to their financial sector. And as a result, as these loans roll off, the balance sheet gaps down very fast. And this means that they're actually constraining the financial supply of money in the European financial markets where the ECB plays. And I think this is a good sort of visual and sort of mental example of how we're going to experience an incredibly volatile inflation and interest rate decade. Because these large balance sheets by the central banks, they can change rapidly. And while they're not actually creating useful money for you and me, they're creating financial money that financial institutions can utilize in some specific ways. And as their balance sheets gap down quickly, as loans are not rolled over, this is essentially money being destroyed. And it's an illustration of how deflation can suddenly punch into the traditional financial system, even in the midst of inflation in the real economy, if that makes sense.
It does make sense and kind of explains what we're seeing right now, at least in the States.
That's right, because I think that inflation is such a complicated issue. The financial system and money is barely understood by anybody, let alone the average person. So it's hard to kind of have two opposing ideas, that of inflation in the real economy, prices going up, which, you know, technically might not be inflation. If the money supply is not increasing, is it really inflation? Maybe prices are just going up because things are more expensive because of the war, etc. You know, this is sort of a big conversation. But the financial money world, the world of money that exists between banks and lenders and corporations, this is a whole separate economy. And this economy is determined by completely different forces than our sort of physical world. And as a result, these movements in central bank balance sheets, they kind of can be indicative of inflation in this financial economy. So what does that mean? I think all things equal, it probably suggests that there are assets in the financial economy that will go down in value because this financial money that would be used by banks or other institutions to speculate in financial markets is being destroyed. I think it's also a sign of pressure on the European Central Bank to at least be seen to be doing something about inflation. Because while the ECB balance sheet isn't directly creating euros in the real economy that are driving inflation, reducing the balance sheet is sort of generally believed to be combating inflation. And so they're taking the opportunity to let loans be closed on their balance sheet, which reduces the value of their balance sheet, and it gives the appearance that they're serious on inflation. When central banks are ready to quote unquote stimulate the economy, they'll signal that by having these balance sheets increase again, I believe. So more bearishness in financial markets is the TLDR.
Yeah, really. But it does sound like there's some things to watch for in there, sort of signals, the tea leaves, if you will.
Right. And it is tea leaves, because I don't know if I've said this outright, but I've definitely over time become much closer to Jeff Schneider's view of the Eurodollar system, which is posited on the idea that central banks are not central banks. They call themselves central banks, but they do not control interest rates. They control some very specific interest rate markets that not a lot of people participate in. And then they say, hey, look, we're controlling the interest rate in this very ancillary, unimportant market over here. Look, we're controlling the interest rate for the whole world. Everyone do what we say. And the important function that they're doing is actually kind of telling everyone in the world, this is what you should be doing right now, according to us. And as long as people believe that, then central bank policy does affect the world. That's kind of a TLDR dismissal of central banks from Jeff Schneider.
Cutting and compelling. That's what I say. As a Bitcoiner, you think, as you're listening during a bear market, you think, all right, yeah, this is why long term I'm betting something else. I'm you know, because you're really kind of, maybe as you stack, you're kind of betting against the system in a sense, or at least the current iteration of it.
You're hedging against this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a great idea, because if what I described puts your mind at ease and makes you think, gosh, I'm so glad Christine Lagarde, a convicted financial criminal, is running the, you know, sort of second largest monetary block in the world, I'm going to sleep well at night. And gosh, you and I don't agree on a lot in the world, I would say.
Man, and it's just that inflation, even if they get it down a bit, right? Like inflation somewhere around 7% here in the States right now, and it's somewhere around 10 is the official inflation number, say in the UK. That's real losses. And even years, you know, even a couple of years of that really is going to hurt people. So I would imagine that system's going to get shakier and shakier. I don't know. That's sort of, you know, I guess the bullish story for Bitcoin.
As we said many times on the pod, the traditional financial system is structurally fragile, meaning that as it gets larger, it gets more fragile. I wish I had an episode where we really get into that to reference, but it's all over the place.
I've long wondered if one day sats will be like little pieces of a currency that are used by world governments, not as their core reserve currency, but as a basket. Like I've always thought, when people complain about there only being 21 million Bitcoin, how could everybody use it for day-to-day transactions? I don't know if I ever really see that. You know, I don't know if I see people using sats to buy coffee long term.
Oh no, no. Why would you?
So much of the authority and ability to stimulate or turn the knob down for a government comes from having their own currency. It's like a critical part of being a large government is having your own currency.
It's a superpower.
Right. I don't see them giving up on that idea. But I could see governments adopting baskets of currency that back it all. And those could be more real, valuable assets based on harder things like energy consumption. That is something I've thought for a very, very long time. I don't know if you're ready to get to Zoltran, but...
That was the perfect lead-in.
I think that's where he's going with this, right?
Exactly. So war and commodity encumbrance is a PDF, so careful clicking on that if you're paranoid, by Zoltan Poznar of Credit Suisse. And this is him developing his concept of a post-dollar reserve currency world. He talks about the multipolar world. That means that there's not just one hegemon, the US, telling everyone how to behave and forcing the use of one currency, but rather there are poles of influence. There's the Russia-China pole. There's the India-China, India-Southeast Asia grouping. There are all these groups, and they all have different policies, and they can't really use a single reserve currency, because if you use the dollar, then the US can punish you at any time, and that's just not politically a good idea to rely on the good behavior of the US to create a neutral system for everybody.
I think we've kind of argued the point that the weaponization of the dollar and of the dollar's transmission system that we've seen, specifically with the Ukraine war, but before that as well, sort of inevitably started this process that Zoltan is implying.
Zoltan takes a quote from the Bretton Woods system, in which a U.S. Treasury secretary said that the dollar is our currency, but your problem, to the European nations, I think in the 70s, who were suffering from energy shocks and hoping for help from the U.S. And Zoltan says that the slogan of the Bretton Woods III system, which is commodity-based, is our commodity, your problem. And his point is that in this world, commodities are what underlie real value. Energy, oil, gas, wheat, chocolate, like the good stuff, the actual good physical stuff is what is valuable in the world. And these commodities can be encumbered. What does that mean? Well, he points out that right now, Russia is shipping energy to India and China, and India and China can rehypothecate this energy. They can send it on to the US or the European Union, and then these entities can buy it at a higher price. And so basically, within these poles of influence, within these little groupings, there might be a different price for commodities. There's no longer a global market for the commodity, because the commodity is now becoming sort of monetized. So there are these monetary premiums in different places on these commodities, if that makes sense.
And you can see the same thing happening with something like lithium.
Oh, 100%. That's a strategic resource that enables all of our mobile electronics and stuff. Super powerful. And at the same time, what we see is that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party that rules over China are moving towards certain places using the RMB as a settlement currency, especially in energy, in oil and gas. And so Zoltan makes a big point of the Shanghai Petroleum and Natural Gas Exchange, which is using RMB settlement in oil and gas trades. He also points out that this use of the renminbi for energy transactions is also related to a Chinese project called MCBDC. If that reminds you of the Bank of International Settlements M-Bridge project, it would not be a coincidence, because the MCBDC is essentially a permission state-level digital currency system where you would have clearing between countries using a digital currency. Why would they do this? Well, it's because Bitcoin has demonstrated that a digital asset can be digital gold. Bitcoin is in many ways similar to, I want to send Chris value, I push a bar of gold through the microphone and it pops out on his side. That's so valuable.
Right.
But for national countries, they haven't yet accepted that Bitcoin is the solution they're looking for. And so they want to create something Bitcoin-like that has those settlement assurances, sort of like Bitcoin, of like transacting physical commodities, like sending gold back and forth. But they want that fast and secure and cheap clearance, because sending gold back and forth in jet planes is very expensive and dangerous.
Yeah, and bags of cash is another popular one. It's interesting when you think of a world where commodities are a different price between China and Russia and India and Iran, and they're a different price when you're buying lithium between the Western nations. And oil is obviously another clear example. I mean, there's so many, all the metals, all of this. When you start to think about regional pricing and the complications that adds, something like Bitcoin, which is a safe, provable digital asset that has basically a world price. I mean, yes, there's your local exchange rate, but there's essentially a world price that the whole world has agreed upon, regardless of where you're at. And it's a sound asset. That's got to be pretty appealing in a very confusing world like that. And yeah, you could try to build your own, but like we see with the LIBOR rate and all those kinds of institutions that inevitably get built out, they always get manipulated and faith gets lost. It'd just be nice to bypass all of that. And one of the greatest features of Bitcoin is that it is for enemies. Even if you don't trust each other, you can still use Bitcoin.
Zoltan's piece is kind of all over the place, and I think you could pick it apart if you wanted to, but it's kind of a fun read. And he points out that as this energy money relationship breaks down, political relationships also change. And he makes a big point of the way that the US sort of separation from Saudi Arabia is really changing the paradigm for both an energy policy, but there's something cultural happening here. The China, in some ways, gets along better with Saudi Arabia because the U.S. held its nose at the Saudi Arabia's monarchy and its clear human rights abuses. But China really doesn't care, because China abuses human rights on a similar scale or a greater scale, perhaps. And so, you know, the confluence of monetary, commodity, and maybe even political and social incentives is creating these new locuses of political power. And that's going to shape our monetary world, our commodity, our energy world. He's making the point that if you're a trader in these markets, politics is the thing you need to worry about. The market fundamentals are no longer fundamental. It's political fundamentals that are changing faster, and that markets have not yet figured this out, that we're still behaving. We're still seeing institutions and traders behaving as if we live in a world of a dollar reserve currency and a global market for commodities, when actually the political world is changing faster than the financial world has noticed.
Right. And the countries and institutions that have to do the most importing, that don't necessarily have all of the resources they need, will be the hardest hit there. And not to make it about energy, but it kind of comes back to energy. You know, it's like the countries with a good, sound energy policy, with good renewable energy, where they're not importing energy, they're going to do the best. Countries that have these assets these resources, you know, lithium stockpiles, helium stockpiles, natural gas stockpiles, water, all of that. We'll do better than the nations that don't, because you're right, the political situation is very dynamic. And it really only takes one more significant political event, like say an invasion of Taiwan, as we record at the end of 2022, for this board to get significantly turned over and upset, and for things to get dramatically more intense.
Do you remember when we reported on a story of Russia requesting oil payment from India and United Arab Emirates dirhams, not in dollars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it turns out that the UAE is a member of the MCDB bridge project. And so these dirhams can actually be sold for CBDC renminbi and transacted with China directly without going through any U.S.-controlled banking pipes.
Yeah, that system's just going to get a lot more use as long as we weaponize the dollar.
The world has already moved away from the dollar backend, but it's like this network scaling problem.
It's still the on and off ramps.
You only move to that backend when you really can't use the dollar
right.
system, because it's a right. smaller network. It's more costly. It's more difficult. I remember when we were talking about Russia moving away from dollars for energy transactions, and we talked about them using gold and eventually using Bitcoin. When I read Zoltan's piece, it makes me think that Bitcoin is going to show up on someone's government balance sheet in the next year. It feels really close.
Ooh, wouldn't that be an interesting little prediction to come true in 2023?
Well, it's going to be the worst country. You know, it's going to be like Venezuela or...
somebody desperate.
Yeah.
That'll be our crew for a little while. It's cool. We understand. We love all types. Bitcoin's for everyone.
Hanging out with our enemies on the bus.
Yeah, man. Maybe we'll show people how to do it right.
Unfortunately, they'll all be dictators.
Well, they're going to need to keep secrets, portable secrets at that.
Did you check out this tool? It's so hacky and cool.
I think, right? I didn't actually run it, but the idea is you'd use two different communications channels and you just encrypt the stuff that goes over those channels to store a secret that allows you to decrypt something.
Yeah, you can basically host web pages, HTML pages that have encrypted content and then access it from anywhere in the world, because anyone can access the web page, but only you have the password and you can pull down the content. So this is hacky. This is probably super risky to use because there's someone else rolling their own crypto here, I think, or parts of it at least. So this is definitely the danger zone. But then the author has a list of all the other projects that do something similar. So this is super cool, kind of good faith, little description of what they're working on and some alternatives. And it just seems like a neat little hacky tool if you're into trying out different privacy and security technologies. Just something I thought you might find amusing.
Well, this year episode of the Bitcoin Dad Pod is brought to you by my show, Self-Hosted, over at jupiterbroadcasting.com. We just kicked off Jellyfin January. We're shutting down our Plex instances, and we're going to run Jellyfin for ourselves, friends, and family for the month of January and see if it can be done. We set a set of ground rules, things that we'll be held accountable to. All of that just kicked off in our most recent episode that'll be posted at selfhosted.show, or just search for Self-Hosted in your podcast app of choice.
Jellyfin is my home media server and client. I think it's fantastic.
I love me the Plex, but I've taken passes at Jellyfin before, and you know what? It's been pretty good. I'm hoping this time I can make it stick.
BitMEX Research is the research arm of the BitMEX Mercantile Exchange, Arthur Hayes, Bitcoin only. Is it Bitcoin only still? I don't know. It's a derivatives exchange. It was kind of usurped by FTX as the place to go complete degen on crypto speculation. But they have a great research division. They supported the publication of that book, The Block Size War, which we read and we promoted or talked about on the show. And they have an article about the latest BSV hard fork and the security considerations associated with it. And I think that it's a really great read so that you can kind of just get a sense of what to think about when chains are hard forking, the security concerns, and specifically what's happening with BSV, which is Craig Wright's fork of Bitcoin. And what I like about this article is that it's very critical of Craig Wright, and it has references, so they're unlikely to be sued because they're not making unsubstantiated claims. They're pointing out that BSV is Craig Wright's creation, who is a person who has put forth various pieces of fraudulent evidence to assert that he is Satoshi Nakamoto, and that the new release of BSV has a feature called digital asset recovery. And it adds a confiscation transaction protocol, which basically means that you can have a way to steal coins with the protocol. And they get into the coin confiscation mechanism and how it works. Should we get into that, or should we maybe talk about why BSV is doing this coin confiscation feature?
Oh, I kind of want to know both. Can I have both?
Of course, always. So basically, to confiscate coins, they create a new type of transaction that can confiscate any coin without the use of the private key that normally is the way that you spend a coin. But there's another side of this, because you have to add this new transaction type, which means that anyone can use the confiscation transaction. But how do you prevent everyone from just start stealing everyone's coins and breaking the system immediately? The way you do that is you have a centrally managed UTXO whitelist. So the whitelist is going to be managed by Craig or some entity he controls, and it's going to whitelist the UTXOs that can be stolen. And this will be a way to control the use of this confiscation transaction feature. That said, the way that the whitelist interacts, it's essentially a miner whitelist. And so you kind of need to control mining on BSV to maintain that whitelist. And this speaks to how centralized BSV is, because BSV nodes, they have large blocks, they use massive amounts of data, both on the storage side and on the network side. I recall hearing stories about BSV proponents who were complaining about the cost of running BSV nodes and asking for donations in Bitcoin to subsidize the cost of running their BSV node because it was so expensive. So this is really kind of a sign of how, in some ways, the centralization of BSV mining might be a feature, because if Craig Wright or entities associated with him are the major mining pools, then they can do things like maintain the chain confiscation whitelist, which allows Craig to steal anyone's coins. That said, if you can collaborate with a BSV miner and issue a coin confiscation transaction, and then your miner manages to mine enough blocks to sort of fix that in the chain, you can use the coin confiscation against Craig as well. This really seems like your typical Craig Wright scheme that is really not very well thought out, because I'm pretty sure with relatively small amounts of money, you can temporarily mine BSV, and you might be able to do something wild, like steal all of Craig's coins or steal all of the coins on BSV and burn them or something. So this just seems like another absolute disaster waiting to happen on Bitcoin Satoshi Vision.
But Craig would tell us that you need, quote, digital asset recovery. So that way you can have a confiscation transaction protocol. Wow. Which also has a field for a court order. So you can put in there the court order that says that it's justified to confiscate. I can't even say the word, to take your coins. This is galaxy brain stuff. I think, you and I will truly come to appreciate how galaxy brain this is in 3 or 4 or 5 years when BSV is taken over as the global currency of the world.
Is that your prediction for 2023?
For Craig Wright's universe, yes.
So there are two potential motivations. One is if you have the ability to steal money, you can steal people's money and sell it, just make profit. I think that falls apart a little in BSV land because the BSV token is really not listed on any major exchanges. And it still has a stated price somewhere of around $40 or something. So you might think, okay, well, if I steal a million $40 tokens, that's $40 million, right? Well, good luck selling it. I just don't think it's a really liquid market.
Oh, and it hasn't been for a while.
You probably can't make anywhere near the amount of real money from BSV that you sell, because who's the buyer is the question. But the second reason makes more sense. I think that if Craig confiscates coins believed to belong to Satoshi Nakamoto on the BSV fork, because remember, when you fork a blockchain, you're inheriting the history of the original chain, and then your new chain has the same history as the old chain, but a new future, which you'll help determine.
A bold new future.
Yeah. Is that a Star Trek reference?
No, but, again, I'm channeling that Craig energy.
So if Craig can confiscate all of the Satoshi coins on the BSV chain, then when he sues developers to make them give him Satoshi's coins on Bitcoin Cash, he can say, look, Bitcoin SV recognized me as Satoshi, never mind the fact that I run the entire project. And therefore, that's more evidence for this court that I'm Satoshi. Now, please fork your software, make everyone run the new software, and give me those coins.
It also can be a demonstrable technical capability. Like, he can show, we've implemented this in BSV. BSV is based off of the original Bitcoin source code. Therefore, it is entirely possible for these developers to implement this. And you just have to compel them to do it.
Right. And of course, once the developers are sued into making software changes, which is just crazy. I mean, imagine being issued a court order to develop software is like being forced at gunpoint to write a novel. Can you imagine the ridiculousness of someone forcing you to do a creative process that's very complicated and nuanced? And you know, if you're in a bad mood, it'll go really badly.
Well, and not to mention it's permissively licensed free software. So you could force a developer, perhaps, with some sort of legal threats to write the code, but then somebody will just write a patch immediately. So there's that element of it. But again, Craig should probably just take, you know, an afternoon, it's not a big book, and read the Block Size War. Because even if you could somehow get enough developers to actually push this code, you're not going to get a single node operator or miner to adopt it.
No chance at all.
Like, they all forget, like everybody, like the hearing I watched a couple weeks ago about the collapse of FTX that had this professor gal who knew nothing about blockchain. Her entire thing that she told Elizabeth Warren is that if you got 10 core developers to make a change to Bitcoin, you could deploy that and everyone would adopt it. And she doesn't understand, and apparently Craig doesn't understand, that there's nodes and miners out there that also play a role in adopting new features. And that distributed consensus mechanism prevents this kind of from slipping in. It's literally impossible. People just won't deploy the code. It's been done before.
Please boost in the addresses of Craig Wright and the unnamed professor, because we'll send them copies of the Block Size War. Maybe it'll help them out.
Merry Christmas from the Dad Pod.
Definitely check out this article if you want to listen to... I mean, there's just a nice tone of thoughtful people looking at something crazy and reasoning about it. That's a thing I like.
No, I follow you. I don't know. There's got to be a name for it. Maybe somebody can boost in the name for it, but I follow you.
And speaking of boosts, it's time for our feedback section. Remember, you can always get in touch with the show, bitcoindadpod@protonmail.com, @bitcoindadpod on Twitter. Consider joining the Jupiter Broadcasting Bitcoin discussion channel on Matrix, and the Bitcoin Dad is a freeloader there.
We build community over there. It's a nice little community we got going.
It is really nice. We received some epic boosts. Shall I try to read this boost from Sir Lurks-a-Lot?
This first boost, it's like the biggest boost any of our shows has ever gotten. This is huge.
Can you read the first one and then I'll do the sequence?
Yeah, sure. All right. So Sir Lurks-a-Lot came in across two boosts with 1.3 million sats. 1.3 million sats. Yeah, a mega boost. He sent one in over Boost CLI and one from the podcast index using Albi. If that was a mistake, you could let us know.
Boost CLI lurks a lot.
Right?
Wow.
Impressive. I know. So Lurks a Lot writes, I know I haven't boosted in for some episodes, but what can I say? Sometimes I'm a lurker. It's in the name. But I can make it up with a big old holiday boost to show my love and appreciation for the show. Keep on doing what you do and keep it value for value. If you earn it, the sats will come. P.S. I did have some problems boosting you from my notes. So let's try Albi. I think we got both of them as far as I know, Lurks. So you let us know. But Lurks was on a marathon boosting sesh. I think this is where you take over.
These boosts have to be read with the Yoda voice. So I'm going to do my best.
I was on the same page. I completely agree.
And I think he wanted me to use the term value caster and value cast.
Is this a new term? It's value cast.
It's kind of confusing. So I'm going to mention that, but I'm going to do podcaster. Okay, if that's okay.
The thing about value cast makes it sound like it's like the cheap brand at the grocery store. You know, the value bread, the value cereal.
Yeah, we might need to consult the Bitcoin marketing CEO about that. A podcaster's strength flows from the audience, but beware the dark side. Advertisements, contracts, obligations, the dark side of podcasting they are. Easily they flow, quick to join in with fiat. If once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny. Consume it you will, as it did Satoshi Wan's apprentice. Vitalik.
That's great.
Is the sponsor side stronger? No, quicker, easier, more seductive. But how am I to know the good side from the bad? You will know when you are calm, at peace, reciprocal. A podcaster uses content to exchange value, never to extract. No, there is no why. Nothing more will I teach you today. Clear your mind of questions.
That's so great. And that was across a series of 1337 boosts. So amazing.
Mega elite boosts. Thank you so much, Lurks-a-Lot.
That's wise words. Wise words, Lurks.
Absolutely.
Smart Growth came in with 5,000 sats. Pete, I think you're referring to from what Bitcoin did, does a stellar job at responding to emails. I can say that from experience. All you folks are doing great work the best way you can.
Thanks, Smart Growth.
Well, thank you, Smart Growth.
I think that it comes across that I'm punching down on Pete, and I definitely am, because I know we're all doing our best. At the same time, some people's bests seem misguided to me. And it's frustrating to have someone who's nearly there, but just kind of disappointing you. That's kind of my perspective there.
Yeah, especially if they never close, they never cross that line. Like, they're always just a few months away from rounding off a good knowledge set about something, or just maybe a couple hours away from being informed about a topic before they sit down to talk about it. But that time just never seems to get spent.
Never happens. Never happens. It's like, at which point do you say, well, is this in good faith?
This is what I think pushes my buttons. It's the equivalent of as if we sat down to do this show and you or I hadn't read any of the stories, but we just saw the headlines and collected them and then just kind of read and talked about them from the surface level. And you and I just sat here and sort of speculated our thoughts about them instead of, like, you know, years of education and then reading and following these individual writers for years and following their concepts and seeing how they pan out and, you know, having an extremely detailed take on it, because that's where the value is. It's just a different approach, though.
Yeah. Arbalest 22 boosts in 1,000 sats. Hello. I don't think I've ever heard you guys mention the Fold prepaid debit card on the pod before. I want to boost in and see if you guys know about it. I feel like a used car salesman saying this, but it's awesome. And then Arbalest goes in to talk about the Fold card. There are a lot of details there, but I think you can check it out if you want to look at it. So, you know, we don't really promote financial products, and I don't really know how Fold works. When I see prepaid debit card, my hackles go up, because prepaid cards are inferior, in my view, to credit cards and things like that. And using debit cards for purchases, that bothers me, because if you buy something in a store with a debit card and someone steals your details and drains your account, you're out of luck. It's not a credit card. You don't have recourse. They manage to steal money from your account, and you'll have very great trouble trying to get that back. So I've just not been that interested in sats back products, because you're giving up your KYC information, your identity. They just seem like a short-term thing to me if Satoshis are as valuable as we think.
I got a credit card that does 1% Bitcoin back. And the reason I did that is because I had about 15 grand over the year of mechanical expenses coming up. And I thought, psychologically, and I know this is so dumb, but psychologically, getting some sats off those transactions made it easier for me to cope with the fact that I had to spend that much money. It made it easier for me to accept it, because in a way I was burning my dirty fiat and I was getting some sats back. And I think what people like about the Fold card is that you put some money on it and then every transaction you get a little bit of sats back. And what I've heard people do is they'll put their reoccurring bills on it and their larger expenses and then get a few sats back. I can't speak to it either. I do get the appeal. I am just really kind of wary of any of this stuff in a bear market right now. You know, maybe it's something I should look into for my kids. Maybe it'd be a way I could throw $100 on there for each one of them and something like that. I don't know. I think from a tax perspective too, the sats that you earn as a reward are not taxed as capital gains. Don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I've been told. Of course, you'd want to do your own research on that. But when you think about it, at a 1% and best case, like, you know, I think it's kind of rare when people get around 3% sats. Like, that's a rare kind of occurrence when they get 3% back.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a promotional rate. They're burning VC money to give you that. So it's not sustainable.
That seems like it. I think they claim that, like, well, what we do is we take some of our revenue from the transaction fees and we buy the sats with that. But then where is their revenue coming from? So again, I have an open mind. Let me know. I don't want to dismiss it out of hand. But in a bear market, I remain pretty skeptical. And it's one of those things where it's like, my incentive here year is let's just wait and let's see how things play out over the next year.
Right. So, I mean, I wouldn't FOMO into a sats-backed card if you're doing dollar cost averaging and buying a little Satoshis every week. I think that's the killer habit if you're into that kind of thing.
I see. They also have a membership plan, $10 a month, and then you get the highest reward level kind of stuff. You get access to like more stuff, 5% back on Amazon gift cards, no ATM fees. Yeah. So you can, maybe that's one of the revenue models is they have two free plans and then a paid plan as well for the Fold card.
These fintech startups are very fragile, in my opinion.
Yes.
They can fall apart very quickly. And if you're relying on it, it can be a real problem.
I kind of look at it like, kind of like the Cash App. There's also the Coinbase debit card. Like you could, you know, you want to throw a few $100 on there and play around. Fine. Maybe you want to pay your monthly cell phone bill. Okay. I wouldn't bet the family finances around it, but I do think there will be a day and an era where we can have safe financial products that are based on Bitcoin. I don't think it's going to be right now, but it might be worth keeping an eye on. Now, we got a boost in from Rapid Mustang for 5,000 sats. I think I've listened to the episode about 3 times in the last 3 days now. He's talking about the one where we got into the IMF and the World Bank and how all of that kind of works to keep the developing nation developing. They write, my first glimpse into this part of the economy was by a video on the YouTube channel Rare Earth about the Banana Republic. That video and this episode really changed and challenged my views on a lot of things, including the role the U.S. plays in the world. Thank you.
Well, Rapid Mustang, if you like our coverage of that article, I encourage you to read the piece in Bitcoin Magazine or on Alex Gladstein's blog, and you can look through the citations. There are a lot of great books on the subject listed there. And I think that Alex has been doing really good work about uncovering and documenting the structural inequality of our financial system. So if that's something that interests you, Alex and the Human Rights Foundation that he works for might be a place to check out and support. We received 1,500 sats from Pixel Jones. Happy holidays. Thank you, men.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, yes.
We're men now, no longer boys.
We are dads after all.
It's true.
Baffo boosts in with 55,555 sats saying, Baffo wishes Merry Christmas. Thank you, Baffo.
Merry Christmas, Baffo. Thank you so much.
Good boost.
And our last big boost from Patar, OG Patar, with again, 55,555 sats. Happy holidays, peace, and love. Thank you so much, Patar. Happy holidays.
Nice to hear from you, Patar. Happy holidays to you, too. Well, thank you to all the boosters. If you got some value from this episode or another episode, please consider sending in a boost. It's a great way to support the show, and we legitimately just love hearing from you. It means a lot to us. One of the easiest ways now these days is to send a boost in directly from the podcast index page. No podcast app change required. You just get Albi in your browser, toss a few sats in there, which you can now do directly with MoonPay inside Albi. Then you find the Bitcoin Dad Pod on the podcast index. We have that linked in the notes. Just right there on their webpage, right there in your good old web browser, you can send a boost in, or you can grab a new podcast app and upgrade to a podcasting 2.0 compatible app at newpodcastapps.com.
This has been the Bitcoin Dad Pod, recorded on Friday, December 30th, 2022. I've been your Bitcoin Dad, and I'm here, as always, with...
with me, Chris. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Have a happy holiday, and thanks so much for an awesome year of podcasting with you all.